Once inside the warehouse, Tom and Bob followed Joe through the garage area and down a wood-floored corridor to Joe's office at the far end, where Mike predicted the meeting would take place. The microphone picks up the footsteps as they approach. David nods to Todd and gives a thumbs-up gesture. The mic indeed is working. They take off their coats and toss them on a wobbly old wood table in the corner. Bob says, offering the now half-empty box, "Want a donut?" Joe takes one and says, "Thanks." Tom, go fill the pot with water and get some coffee started. He hands Tom a glass coffee pot. At the club, they hear Tom's heavy footsteps as he retreats down the hall. Joe says, "Take a seat. Pete should be calling soon." Bob sits down. Tom returns a minute later. They hear him fumbling with the coffee maker, followed by the sound of a chair being moved as Tom sits next to Bob. Joe is behind his big wooden desk covered with papers. He leans back on the old office chair, which creaks and squeaks, and asks, "Okay, you two, tell me what happened last night." They relate the events of the night and their theory of how they were ID'd. Joe finally says, "You're probably right. The bouncer recognized you." "Yep, Mike's there. This all fits. Sorry about the bum's rush you guys got," he says, actually sounding concerned. He pulls out his wallet and says, "Here's $100. Go buy some new coats. Those look a bit worse for wear." Tom takes the bill and says, "Thanks, Joe. We appreciate it." Joe's cell phone rings. He answers it. It's Pete, who says he's a few blocks away. "Yeah, Pete, no problem. Everything's fine. We're here waiting for you," says Joe, then hangs up. He's a total fucking paranoid. Never trusts anyone or anything. "He should be here in a couple of minutes. Tom, go wait by the door and let him in." Tom gets up and walks back to the door where he waits, looking through a small side window near the door, out across the street at the parking lot. On schedule, a few minutes later, a black SUV with Polk County, Iowa plates pulls into the lot and parks next to Joe's car. David's van camera quickly focuses in on it and its two occupants as they get out and stand in front of the hood waiting. The video appears on David's monitor. Right behind it, a blue SUV drives in. From it jumps a guy in his mid-30s. "That's Pete, the one that's getting out of the second SUV," says Mike. "And the others would have to be Mark and Sid." Mark and Sid are ordinary-looking guys in their late 20s, wearing heavy parkas, stocking caps, thick gloves, and heavy, laced-up, high-top boots. Both from Iowa, after high school, they wandered from one job to another, not really interested in anything that required getting up in the morning. Eventually, they discovered their calling and began, much like Tom and Bob did, doing odd jobs for the mob. But unlike Tom and Bob, Mark and Sid both truly enjoy the suffering they inflict on others and quickly advance in the art and practice of schadenfreude. Pete, in his mid-30s, is dressed more like a businessman in a top coat, cream-colored cashmere scarf, thin black leather gloves, and a sporty, fur-lined hat. Pete began as a small-time street hood who worked his way up in the organization. He started a small gang in high school and terrorized anyone he thought he could shake down, quickly cornering the market for drugs and prostitution in his neighborhood. He left his first victim by the side of the road when he was 17. "A hit and run," said the police, someone who got in Pete's way. After dropping out of school, he was avidly recruited by just about every crime operation in the Mississippi Valley. Eventually, he caught the eye of the right people and soon found himself moving up in life. He adopted the dignified outward appearance of a businessman, but if you look at him up close, you quickly encounter the visible darkness of his feral squint. Ever snarling thin lips, gaunt cheekbones, and beady eyes confess the hungry leer of a natural predator. Pete looks suspiciously around to see if he's being watched, then turns and pulls a laptop case from the rear hatch of the SUV. The only sound is that of wind, the distant screams of steel wheels against steel rails, and a screeching crow circling high above. The threesome walk quickly across the deserted street to the warehouse door, which Tom holds open. At Mulroon, they hear random noises, mainly sounds from the nearby railroad yards, and the occasional shuffles of shoes from those waiting nervously in the office. Soon, muffled voices can be heard and the building sound of approaching footsteps. Then the rumble of chairs being moved on the wooden floor as Joe and Bob get up to greet Pete and his aides. Joe says, "Hey, Pete, glad to see you. Mark, Sid, come on in. Take a seat. Tom, get their coats. Y'all know Tom and Bob? Hey, Joe, how's it going? You sure have one shitload of snow over here. It's still drifting out on the interstate. Glad I wasn't out driving in it a couple of days ago," says Pete. "There's some hot coffee and donuts over there." "Thanks." The other sits silently while Pete gets coffee and a donut. A minute later, with his mouth full, he begins, "Okay, Joe, let's get down to business. Any idea what the connection is between Mike and the Shea guy?" "No idea, Pete. Shea keeps pretty much a low profile." "Joe, I'm on a tight schedule. Certain people want Mike taken out of circulation now, and by now, they mean now. Am I being clear?" "Yeah, very clear." "Right. So if that's where he is, I want to know what we're up against." "We'll do what we can. We don't want any problems," says Joe. "So what do we got? Mike's living in an apartment on the top floor of a fort with regular food deliveries and a security staff," says Pete. "Yeah, kind of looks that way," says Joe. "Not good. Question is, how are we going to handle it? First, they know we're on to them. I suppose we could try to break in the place during the day, but the main entrance will be bolted, and, unless they're real stupid, the loading dock will be guarded. We try to go in when the place is open. That's a whole other set of problems. So what's the plan, Joe?" "We force them out," says Pete. "Find out how they get their electricity. I want to know how to shut their lights out." "You bet. I'll get right on it," says Joe. "I want to do it tonight. Jack will like that. Have some guys standing by for around around 9 or 10 tonight. No problem. What do you got planned, says Joe. We cut the power, light some fires, set up a few smoke bombs. With a big crowd, we start a panic and get the place evacuated. Your guys can take care of them on the street. I figure we can go in about 10 tonight. Any problem with that? Nope, shouldn't be a problem. I'll find out which substation feeds the place and have it destroyed, says Joe, taking notes. Who's going to do the fire and smoke part on the inside? Mark and Sid. At 10, when the power goes out, you two will start some fires and set off smoke bombs, okay? Sure, Pete, no problem. Tom, you said there was a stage with curtains. What's it made of? Asks Pete. Wood. Good. Was there an emergency exit near the stage? Asks Pete. There were exits on both sides. Good. After you set off the smoke bombs, one of you goes out the emergency exit next to the stage. Won't that set off the alarm? I kind of guess all the alarms will be going off by then. Oh, yeah, sure. Once that emergency door is open, I want some big fire bombs tossed in there on the stage and on the curtains. Let's set it on fire for real. No problem. How many guys do you want on the outside? Asks Joe. My guess is when he comes out, it'll be from one of the exits nearest the elevator. About six of your guys should do it, along with Tom, Bob, Mark, and Sid. Make sure everyone gets copies of the picture of Mike so they know what he looks like. Will do, says Joe. Where can we get some smoke bombs? Asks Pete. There's a fireworks store just down the interstate, west of town, says Tom. Mark, you and Sid go get some this afternoon, and get some small bottles and fill them with gasoline or something that burns. I want to light the coat room while we're at it. Parkas probably burn real nice this time of year, says Pete. No problem, says Mark. Okay, this is it. 10 o'clock. Joe cuts the power. When the lights go out, Mark and Sid set off some smoke bombs. Light fires inside the coat room, then hit the exits. Joe's guys toss in some real fire bombs and set as much of it on fire as possible. The club empties in panic. Your guys nail Mike. St. Louis is fucking ecstatic. We all go home happy. I prefer it that way, says Joe. Good. We don't have much time. Mark, I'll call your cell phone after I've checked in and give you my room number. Oh, and Joe, have that place watched in case he tries to leave. If so, you know what to do. Maybe he might make it easy for us. I've already got some guys over there covering it. Where are you staying, says Joe? Regency Hotel. Give me the address of that club so I can drive by on my way, and call me if anything develops. Joe writes out the address and directions on how to get to Maroon. The meeting breaks up. Pete goes to his SUV and drives to Maroon. His car slowly circles the place, looking at the outside defenses, noting the two loading docks, the emergency exits, and the massive front entrance door as video cameras on the roof high above watch his every move. He parks a block away and slowly smokes a cigarette. He studies the place with the eyes of a killer. After a few minutes, he tosses the cigarette out the window into the snowbank and drives off to find his downtown motel. Time, noon. As Tom, Bob, Mark, and Sid cross over to the parking lot, Tom gives Mark the directions to the fireworks store off the interstate. In the parking lot, Bob says, Hey, you guys interested in getting something to eat? Mark says, Yeah, good idea. We've been on the road nearly 3 hours. There was a lot of snow blowing across the interstate, so we didn't make very good time. Sure. Any preferences? Says Sid. How about that prairie buffet I saw signs for a couple of exits back on I-80? You ever been there? Says Mark. Yeah, it's good. All you can eat. I like it. We go there a lot. Hasn't killed us yet, says Tom. Just the kind of place I like. Not deadly, says Sid. They all laugh. Bob says, pointing to Tom, Yeah, but you don't want to have him for a roommate after their Mexican special nights. Sure seems like something died. Again, more laughs. Okay, we'll risk it. You guys want to ride with us? We need to come back this way anyhow, says Mark. Sure, says Bob, and they all get into Mark's Jeep. Mark starts the engine and they drive away, all four wheels spinning on the icy packed snow. The Jeep drives back onto the interstate and travels east for a couple of exits, then down onto a commercial four-lane road running north-south. All along it are the usual collection of gas stations, fast food outlets, supermarkets, and strip malls. Garish multicolored signs on tall, round steel posts wobble in the brisk wind. The brilliant white snow cover beneath a cloudless sky is blinding. Traffic is light as the weather has brought many activities to a halt. Mark jerks the Jeep into the parking lot, bouncing over the unseen curb hidden by the snow. He parks the Jeep and all four jump out and jog to the restaurant. They pay the lunch admission, get a table, then help themselves to plates of fried chicken, french fries, meatballs, ribs, ham, mini corn dogs, Salisbury steak, hush puppies, macaroni and cheese, hash browns, corn, onion rings, and stuffing. A couple of trips later, they've surrounded themselves with pop, bread, butter, salads, and fruit bowls. Sitting down, they begin the task of eating the mounds of food like a pack of coyotes, only not as neatly. A manager in the corner rolls his eyes and cringes as he calculates the fiscal hit. Mark says, So, Mike's days are numbered, it seems. You ever meet Mike? Answers Tom. No, but I've talked to him on the phone a few times, says Sid. Same here, adds Mark. So I guess he won't be able to ID us at that bar. So, what's this club like? Asks Mark. Maroon? Fucking huge. Really nice. Block on each side. 5 stories high. Hundreds of people. They got a great band. Lots of women, says Bob. So what do you think Pete'll do if this smokeout doesn't work? Says Tom. I think Mike's too smart to walk out and let Pete take a shot at him. But Pete knows what's going to happen to him if he doesn't take care of Mike. So if this stunt tonight doesn't work, Pete will just figure out some way to break in there, says Mark. And that won't be easy. Like he said, it's a fucking fort. And even if he did get in, I don't see how anyone's going to get up to the top floor. That place has a lot of security guards. We met a few of them. them. We know. They'll be ready, says Bob. Well, Pete better think of a way, because Jack's bullshit. He'll fucking blow the place up if Pete doesn't get Mike real quick, says Sid. So, Mike really ran off with the goods, says Tom? Oh, yeah. We hear he's got crap on the mob, not only in St. Louis, but half the freaking country. Jack either silence him, or Jack's got problems. Real big problems. And right now, that means Pete's got problems. Big problems. You guys are lucky he didn't line you up against the brick wall at the warehouse and blow your fucking brains out. He wasn't happy about you two being ID'd, said Sid, menacingly. Tom and Bob suddenly look ashen. They turn their heads and look to each other for an instant, both suddenly very scared. Tom's hand trembles a bit. Tom clears his throat and says, quickly correcting a high pitch for the first word, You don't think he'd really do that, do you? Mark leans over a bit and looks intently first at Bob and then Tom and says, oh yeah, he'd do that. You guys got off easy. If you hadn't got that information about the apartments on the top floor, you'd both be a couple of bloodstains on the floor back at Joe's place. You did notice the bloodstains on the concrete.